Welcome to Om Times TV, a division of Om Times Media and Broadcasting. Welcome to the No BS Spiritual Book Club's live streaming interview series, where leading new thought teachers, speakers, and authors share the intimate stories behind the 10 best spiritual books that inspired them the most on their spiritual journey. From well-known classics to hidden gems you might never have heard of, the No BS Spiritual Book Club saves you time and money by sharing reliable recommendations from those who've walked the path before you. The No BS Spiritual Book Club, the only No BS guide to the best spiritual books to inspire your own journey of self-discovery. Here's your host, founder of the No BS Spiritual Book Club, Sandy Sedgebeer.
Hello and welcome. Joining me today to share the 10 best spiritual books that inspired him the most on his life journey is award-winning teacher and international speaker Christopher M. Baish, whose latest book, LSD and the Mind of the Universe, is, in my opinion, probably the most important book of our time. Chris Baish is Professor Emeritus in the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at Youngstown State University, where he taught for 33 years. He's a fellow at the Institute of Noetic Sciences and advisory board member for Groff Transpersonal Training and the Groff Foundation. And if you want to know why I regard LSD and the Mind of the Universe as the most important book of this time, stay tuned. We'll find out more about that later in the show. Meantime, Chris Baish, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sandy. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
I'm always intrigued to know what books our guests will choose, but I've been especially keen to learn and share with our audience your 10 best spiritual books. When I saw it, I saw the list, I said, well, that is one list, the only one so far, where all 10 books are favorites of mine.
Well, that's good to hear.
So how did you find the process of having to pick just 10?
It's kind of interesting that there were so many books to choose from. And in the process of choosing the ones that spoke most deeply to me at any particular time in my life, I found myself kind of drawn to kind of more intellectually oriented books because I'm an academic. And at the end, I was quite struck by how much I don't know. You know, the books helped me so much, but there's so much that I've left untouched in the spiritual field.
Wow. Well, I beg to differ. And our audience will find out later why I say that. I mean, when you say there's so much you need to know, I would have thought, you know what we all want to know, and that's enough.
It's not so much what I need to know, it's just stuff that I don't know. I feel content with what I have learned through my journey. Yeah.
But the don't know bit, I mean, yeah. You know, we can go on forever there, can't we? So your first book, understandably, is Stanislav Grof, Realms of the Human Unconscious, Observations from LSD Research, published in 1975. You're a great supporter of his work, aren't you?
I am. I think Stan's work is so critically important to the emerging paradigm in transpersonal psychology. And I came upon this book right after I was out of graduate school, just beginning my teaching career, just beginning to look around for where to take my research next. And I came upon this first book by Stan that was published just 2 years before. And as soon as I read it, it activated something in me, and I knew I needed to get involved in this process. Even though psychedelics were illegal at the time, this was almost 8 years after they had been made illegal, I nevertheless decided to begin what became a 20-year journey working with LSD in a therapeutic protocol that Stan lays out, working with high-dose sessions. Not as a clinician, I wasn't a psychologist, I wasn't primarily oriented towards healing. I'm a philosopher of religion by trade. I was interested in the cosmological significance of these substances, how they would give us, they had the potential to show us new insights into the deep structure of the universe. And it that book just really sort of lit the fuse for me.
Well, how old were you then?
I was 30 years old. Yeah.
Wow. And that started your 20-year journey.
Yeah, between 30 and 50. That's really the book that started it all for me. Yes. And of course, I read all of Stan's books as they came through. And I always felt that my books were largely, first and foremost, in dialogue with Stan's work.
So book number two, Ian Stevenson, 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation, published in 1966.
Yeah, I met this book at the same time I met Stan's book. And at the time, I was a deeply convinced agnostic with strong atheistic leanings. And I encountered this book by Stevenson, which I think presents overwhelming evidence, the first of many books of his that present overwhelming evidence that reincarnation is simply a fact of life. It's a natural fact of life, which required that I erase my entire intellectual blackboard because reincarnation had never been taken seriously by any of the courses that I had taken in college or graduate school. I had to erase the blackboard and start from scratch, which resulted eventually about 10 years later in my publishing my book on reincarnation, Life Cycles, which is my response to Ian Stevenson's pioneering work.
So when you, I'm getting a bit of feedback now. When you went down that path, did you risk, the ire of your colleagues?
I did. Actually, I went on sabbatical, my first sabbatical. And I had not planned to write a book. I had not planned to write this book, but I came back with the book, the manuscript of the book. And my colleagues were not terribly happy with it, but it got published and then it got translated into several foreign languages and they began to pay more attention to the subject matter.
So it didn't affect your career?
It didn't. I was afraid that it might when I first did it, but this is a kind of a personal karmic thing. I've paid the penalty for going against the grain in former lives. This lifetime, it seems that it's important for me to continue to go against the grain and not receive any negative consequences and only receiving positive consequences.
Mm. Book number three, Journey of Souls, Case Studies of Life Between Lives by Michael Newton, published in 1994.
Yeah. Michael Newton's work is so beautiful and so important. He started as a past life therapist, then accidentally gave an ambiguous instruction to a client through which he learned that we could regress people not only to their former lives, but we could regress people to the time in between their death and their subsequent rebirth. And he began to give us not an autobiographical, people's individual experiences of what happened to them in their time between their incarnations. And his series of books just were fantastic about this. They had not been published when I published my book at first, but they certainly do complement it very beautifully.
I mean, he really was a pioneer there, wasn't he? I mean, so many people I speak to trained with Michael Newton.
Yeah. Really was. And his description of the Bardo existence concurs with my experience in psychedelics completely, with the provision that I think he's seeing more the lower half of the Bardo, not the upper edges of the Bardo. But yeah.
Mm. Well, book number four is Lessons from the Light, What We Can Learn from the Near-Death Experience by Kenneth Ring. And that one was published in 1998.
Yeah. Which one of these books by each of these authors we focus on? Kenneth Ring has always been a colleague and friend. He wrote the foreword to Life Cycles. His work on near-death episodes was so critically important. I taught a course for many years at the university called Transpersonal Studies, in which we always included near-death episode research. And I always used Ken Ring's books because they were so accessible to the students and so well researched. And this book is kind of Ken's last book on near-death episode research. It's an overview, it's a compendium. It contains beautiful passages, all sorts of empirical analysis. But my favorite chapter in the book comes towards the end, where he's describing the deepest near-death episodes that he has recorded, and they are just magnificent. Personally, as a psychedelic-oriented person, I feel deepest compatibility or a deepest resonance with people who have had deep near-death episodes.
So, continuing the theme, Robert Monroe, Far Journeys, his best-selling classic, published in 1985.
Yeah, Robert Monroe has been a real companion to me on the journey through his works. This book came out when I was on my first sabbatical, and I was writing life cycles. And this book came out, and I immediately made a reservation to go and do a week's training program at the Monroe Institute, because I was so impressed by his work. And then I went back one more time right after he passed to go back to the Monroe Institute for a week's training to say goodbye. Monroe, I think, is an understudied figure in the consciousness community. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe it's because he's on the East Coast and doesn't penetrate West Coast circles so much. But the model of the universe that he presents, that emerged over decades of his going out of his body every night, every time he went to sleep, is just a stunning model. Idiosyncratic, very candid. Monroe just says it, calls it like he sees it. But it's a very compatible model with Eastern, particularly Buddhist cosmology, the structure of the bardo, the large model. I think it's just a fantastic excursion. And I've read it multiple times through the years.
Did you have many journeys when you were there?
You know, getting out of my body is never an aptitude that I seem to have developed. When I was there, I had definitely non-ordinary states of consciousness, expansive, diffuse, and states of consciousness where I was able to make contact, for example, with people who had died and were in the bardo, but they weren't accompanied by the sensation of being out of my body. And this is true for all my psychedelic work. I never had the sensation of leaving my body. Rather, my consciousness expanded exponentially beyond the limits of my body, but not as kind of a separate consciousness, individualized consciousness traveling out.
Mm. I always wanted to go there. I never got there, but I did attend a weekend session by somebody who had trained to do it, and it didn't really work for me.
Didn't.
I was so disappointed.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. Book number six, by a man whose work I love, Duane Elgin, Choosing Earth, Humanity's Great Transition to a Mature Planetary Civilization, published, I think that was 2020, but there's been a new edition published.
Yes, he's updated it, put it in a new edition. Mm. Duane Elgin is a dear friend, great colleague, he's one of my heroes. He's been trying to raise the alarm about humanity's peril and what we're doing to the planet and the limitations of our understanding of the universe, the consequences of buying into a materialist paradigm instead of a living universe paradigm. One of his books, The Living Universe, from his first book on voluntary simplicity, where he points us where we need to be going, reducing our impact on the planet, living a simpler life with more focus on what we want to achieve with our life, not a life of doing less, but a life of doing more with less. But this book, Choosing Earth, is a distillation of decades and decades of his thinking on the Earth. He lays out a very carefully, scientifically informed proposal for what the next 50 years are going to look like, decade by decade. And then he follows this with a series of recommendations for how we can consciously and intelligently engage this crisis and work to ensure a better outcome. It's just it's a beautiful book. And his wife, Colleen, has produced a film that is the companion to the book. So you, and they're giving away the book and giving away the film for free. Dwayne says, it's too important. We are right now, things are too important to try to make money out of this peril.
Do you know where people can go to find the movie and what's it called?
It's called, oh my goodness, I'm having a senior moment here. You can go to Dwayne Elgin's website, okay. DwayneElgin.com. And his books are listed there, and the movie is there. His wife's name is Colleen LeDrew Elgin.
Yeah, I'll check it out.
Yeah.
Number seven, another author whose work I admire tremendously, Rupert Sheldrake, A New Science of Life, The Hypothesis of Morphic Resonance, published in 1981.
Again, a person who's written such an extraordinary series of books. When I was trying to understand, as I say in my notes here, when I was trying to understand why my psychedelic purification healing experiences had expanded so exponentially to include hundreds of thousands of human beings, the whole breadth of the human species, and later when I was trying to understand some of the dynamics that were showing up in my classroom that seemed this permeability between my mind and my students' mind, Rupert Sheldrake's work was really helpful to me and very important because he helped me understand that our individual minds of every being is always also simultaneously networked into a species mind. So that as the species learns, the individual learns. As the individual learns, the species learns, and a complex feedback dynamic. And this was extraordinarily helpful it helped me make the transition of thinking about what was happening in my sessions in terms of a personal model of transformation into a collective model of transformation. And this became the primary theme of my second book, Dark Night, Early Dawn, where I'm really talking about the collective, the dark night of our collective soul, the transformation of our collective soul. And that has Rupert's fingerprints all over it.
He took a lot of flack, didn't he?
He
really has, had to fight the good fight there. And yet he's said to me that some of the people who publicly deny his work privately do not.
Yeah, too often in academia, we have our public reputations and our private convictions that don't match our public positions. Yeah.
Sad, isn't it?
Yeah.
People don't feel that they can be authentic and say what they think.
Yeah. And Rupert's been just a real hero in challenging the status quo in scientific thought and just pushing the issues on the table that he believes in.
Yeah. So book number eight, Richard Tarnas, Cosmos and Psyche, Intimations of a New World View, published in 1996.
Yeah. Rick Tarnas is another colleague and dear friend, an extraordinary astrologer. After establishing his professional reputation as an historian of intellectual thought with his book, Passion of the Western Mind, he then came out with this book, Cosmos and Psyche, in which he makes the case that astrology not only illumines the lives of individuals, and he demonstrates this very powerfully in the book with known historical figures, but that astrology can be used to illumine historical epochs. And it's the larger thesis, which is so particularly provocative, is his analysis of history in terms of the rhythms of the archetypal astrological pulses of our solar system and showing a correlation between the quality of the archetypal energies that are being brought into focus from an astrological lens to looking at what's actually happening at an historical level and showing the correlations. And I think it's an extraordinarily important and very valuable book. Also a real tour de force. You have to strap in when you read one of Rick's books.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. I was looking it up earlier, and I think it was the contents list. One of the things on there that caught my eye, because it really relates so much to your work and what's in your book, The Transformation of the Cosmos, The Birth of the Modern Self, and The Dawn of a New Universe, which is pretty much where we are now. The Birth of the Modern Self, I mean, you talk about the future human in your book. What is the modern self?
I think the modern self is the birth that was given, is the self sense that was given birth to in the Age of Enlightenment. And it's the rational self. It's that gives birth to science, the scientific self. And I think what we're seeing is now that the modern self is thoroughly and deeply established, the modern self is someone who, like Martin Luther, can pound his 96 theses on the door of the cathedral and basically say to this multi-hundred-year-old religious tradition of the Roman Catholicism, you're wrong, and you're wrong on this, this, and this. That self consolidated within ourselves so that we can become critical, turn a critical lens on our history and our culture and our context. That self, now thoroughly established in history, is yielding to a postmodern self, I think. And that's the future human that so many of us are feeling, intuiting, and experiencing in our contemplative practices. The postmodern self doesn't negate the modern self, but it reconnects the modern self to the underlying deeper fabric of consciousness that runs through all things, not only through all human beings, but through all of life. So the modern self is being recontextualized within the larger fabric of existence. And that is, I think, the future human. And the way I understand that the technical parts of that is in terms of the birth of the diamond soul.
Mm. Well, we will talk more about that after the break. So book number 9, Sri Aurobindo, or The Adventure of Consciousness by Sat Prem, published in 1968.
Sri Aurobindo is one of my heroes. He's just such a brilliant man, Oxford educated, and Hindu saint and guru, transitioned from being a political activist to being a spiritual activist. And he more or less channeled all his books. I mean, apparently all of his books were written within 6 years. He just channeled them. But they're very dense. They're, you know, you really have to sit down with a cup of coffee if you're going to read Aurobindo, because he's so rich. Sat Prem has written a biography which basically extracts the core insights that Aurobindo presented in his writing, but he does it in a way which makes them more accessible to the average reader like me. And I really appreciated Sat Prem because he gives me a backdoor way into Aurobindo's thought, and it makes it easier for me when I want to tackle the primary text.
Mm. We had a guest on a few months ago who recommended, I don't know if it was this book, but one of his, and was talking about how he and the mother, I believe it was, mm-hmm. During the war, they would meditate and they would basically send thoughts, to Hitler. Good thoughts, yeah. And they would see, and they'd send thoughts to Churchill as well. Mm-hmm. And they basically sent one particular thought to Churchill about how he would mobilize, the British spirit, mm-hmm. To back him completely. Mm-hmm. And in fact, what he then said in his next speech was almost word for word what they had transmitted.
Yeah. They live in the truth of the open expanse of mind, and that our individual thoughts and minds, when focused, can travel into the ocean of consciousness and reach your intended destination.
Yes. Yeah. It made me, I've got to put him on my reading list. The last book is The Flight of the Garuda, Teachings of the Dzogchen Tradition of Tibetan Buddhism by Keith Dowman, published in 1994.
Yeah. Well, Vajrayana Buddhism has been a large influence on me. And the challenge I had was, which of the many books that have moved me so deeply in Buddhism could I put here? One that I considered almost put, so I just want to mention, is the book Graceful Exits, which is a story of how great beings, enlightened beings, die. It's a collection by, of just the death experiences of enlightened beings. But I chose in the end one of my favorite tantric texts, The Flight of the Garuda, which basically was a bit controversial when it was first published, because many traditional Vajrayana practitioners did not believe that he should have made public such an esoteric text as this. Personally, I love it. When I read a tantric text like this, I'm always bringing to it all of my background in psychedelic experience. And when I read this text and his commentary, I just feel illumined. I feel so at home with it, and I learn so much from it that helps me process my own psychedelic experiences. Dzogchen is considered the fastest path, the direct path in Vajrayana Buddhism. It's a form of Buddhist practice which more or less kind of starts at the end, instead of kind of developing stage by stage up the mountain. It kind of draws upon the insight that where we end up at the end of our spiritual practice, our end of our journey in enlightenment, is in a condition which always existed from the very beginning. It's not something which is brought into being, but it is always there, never changes, never ceases to exist, never begins to exist. Once you know that, then you can build your spiritual practice around the fact of this pre-existing condition, the direct path. And that's what this book is coming out of.
Of those 10 books, do you have a favorite?
Oh, I have so many. I guess I've lived my life around the first two, Stevenson and Stan Grof, just because I believe that reincarnation is an absolutely essential understanding to life. And psychedelics have been the way for me to personally explore the deep structure of the universe. So I guess I'd have to say those, but all of them are favorites of mine. They're all on my must-read list.
Well, some of these people you know. Of those that you don't know, who would you most like to meet?
Of those I don't know? Well, I would love to have met Michael
Newton.
Yeah, he's now passed on, so I'll be looking him up when I die, that's for sure. just because he contributed so much to my life.
Yeah. I bet you're not the only one who'll be looking him up.
Yes. You know, Marvin Monroe says we can go anywhere and find anyone that we want when we die. All we have to do is know their ID, you know. And so we can check up on people.
That'll keep us busy until we come back again.
I guess, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's your 10 best list, but it's by no means the whole of this show. We're going to take a brief break now, and when we get back, put your listening ears on. Okay. You're listening to a No BS Spiritual Book Club interview and sharing the 10 best books that had the biggest influence on his life journey. Today is award-winning teacher, international speaker, and author of the seminal book, The Mind, LSD and the Mind of the Universe, Diamonds from Heaven. We'll be back with more from Christopher Baish after the break. Stay tuned.
Om Times TV.
Maya Angelou once said that there is no greater agony than bearing an untold story inside you. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and when I'm not hosting Om Times Media's flagship radio show, What Is Going On, and the No BS Spiritual Book Club, I help people share their untold stories. Books are my life, my joy, and my passion. And there is no greater reward than helping aspiring writers get their books out of their heads and into the hands of those who are waiting to read them. If you feel that you have a book in you, but don't know where to begin, visit sedgbeer.com, click on the Work With Me tab, and find out how my experience helping others tell their stories might be just what you've been looking for. That's sedgbeer.com, sedgbeer.com.
Imagine becoming a super influencer. Reinvent yourself, invest in your brand, and then manifest your success with a robust spheric approach. OWN Times Media and Broadcasting offers a unique and multifaceted way to become the spiritual and conscious influencer you deserve to be by putting your message across our powerful platform with its proven record of integrity and excellence. Through our produced shows, OWN Times offers the opportunity to become a social media TV personality, a radio show host, an OWN Times magazine columnist, and a syndicated podcaster, all in one shot. By live streaming your show on OWN Times TV and broadcasting it across the extensive OWN Times radio and TV networks, you become more than a host. You become an ambassador and a force for positive change. OWN Times. Open yourself to the possibilities.
There are 16 million children struggling with hunger in America. That's one in five daughters, sons, neighbors, and classmates who don't know where their next meal is coming from. Yet billions of pounds of good food go to waste every year. It's time we do something about it. Feeding America is a nationwide network of food banks that helps provide meals to millions of kids and families in need. Visit feedingamerica.org to help them feed even more. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're feeding America.
Welcome back. Christopher Bache, in 1979, you embarked on a life-changing journey. You said to explore your mind and the mind of the universe as deeply and as systematically as possible with the help of LSD. And over the next 20 years, you experienced 73 high-dose sessions following Stan Grath's protocols. Those journeys, which were intensely grueling and also equally blissful, took you beyond the beyond, took you to a place I would love to go, into a unified field of consciousness that underlies all physical existence. There's so many questions, We won't have time for all of them. But why don't you tell us, what is the most important thing that you think we need to know that you learned on those journeys?
Oh, that's a hard question. First thing that pops in my mind is, don't do what I did. You know, I wouldn't do it the same way if I did it over again. But I would be much gentler on myself. And that's partly one of the things I learned was I thought the purpose of this work was to kind of get to an end state, that there was an end state that would change my life, transform my life. And what I learned along the way, and I was 17 years into this journey at this point, is that it's an infinite progression. It's an infinite universe. You'll never get to the end of it. And so the whole project of pushing as hard as I did with the thought that I could get to the end of it was just, it was a mistaken concept that I brought to it. You know, what happens in a psychedelic state is an amplification of what's taking place in life in ordinary processes. So in order to understand what happens in a psychedelic state, you have to know what's happening in ordinary life. And here I think we have to come understand reincarnation. We have to understand that this is the rhythm of life, that we are a cosmic being, that we are a being that lives in time frames of hundreds of thousands, millions of years, that this particular incarnation is only one of many incarnations on this planet. In order to understand what life is about, we have to look not in terms of the one short-term 100-year-old lifespan. We have to think in terms of the soul's lifespan, which is vast. So that's the first thing, is an underscoring and reinforcing of reincarnation. Also, just the encounter with the living intelligence, which is, I call it the mind of the universe, because our concepts of the divine and God have so many cultural limitations built into them through history. I don't want to affirm those, though I do sometimes speak of the divine, less often, but I'll talk about God. But the consciousness which one can encounter, which one can dissolve into, the intelligence, the genius, I mean, just to experience briefly the intelligence of the mind that's generating the universe, and the compassion and love and wisdom. And you know, when you just look at life, it looks hard. I mean, it is hard, and it looks like it could have been created by a despot, because it is so seemingly cruel. But in order to understand the genius of it and the wisdom of it and the compassion of it, you have to be able to step back and look very deep. It's like stepping back off of the planet to understand what's happening on the planet. And in that context, you can experience the universe as this magnificent garden that has been created specifically for our transformation, our share of it, our transformation. And we have unlimited amount of time to continue to learn and grow in this garden. And it's not an easy garden. It's a hard place to live and grow, but it offers us infinite potential to develop the essential being that we are. And our essential being is the divine being, our light of the divine. We come from the divine. We are a spark of the divine light. And yet we're small and kind of immature in the early stages, but we develop it and develop it and develop it until eventually we can become a being that has complete control over their incarnation, complete control over the health of their body, complete control over the wealth of their mind and creativity. And we're growing and growing and growing in this direction, toward that direction. And I guess one of the other major takeaways is an understanding of where we are in history, where humanity is. And here, so many visionary experiences that humanity is coming to a turning point. Humanity is coming to a bifurcation point, a radical deconstruction followed by a reconstruction at a higher organizational level. I think we are entering, after hundreds of thousands of years of reincarnation, where we have been gestating the future human, lifetime by lifetime by lifetime, gestating the future human's form, we are now have entered the period of labor. And the day of labor is a very intense, very dangerous time, very painful time. But when it's over, the mother gives birth to a new child. And I think humanity is in the process of giving birth to a new child, to the latest iteration of its own fundamental form. I think we're witnessing in this century and the next a shift in the collective psyche, a shift in the fundamental architecture of the collective unconscious, so that all future beings who are born after we make this transition will be living in the context of a different fundamentally structured psyche. This is what I call the birth of the diamond soul. I think that after all these years of incarnating, we are reaching a period in history where these lives are coming together inside us. And as they come together, we first have to purify and heal all their broken and hurt pieces. But as we do that, they move into deeper and deeper synthesis. And eventually, either gradually or suddenly, there is an ignition that takes place and the soul is born. And that is, the soul is the intelligence that holds all of our experiences through all of our incarnations. And that, I think, is the emerging future human in history. The soul is being born inside human history. So how can I pick and choose which of those concepts are the most important?
Yeah, I know. Well, yeah. You said in the book that there are many, many layers to heaven and to the death experience, and that there is no hell, but there is confrontation and accountability. Is that what many people, regard as the life review.
Yeah.
Karma.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit more about that.
You know, our understandings of the God and our understandings of life have been so primitive historically. I mean, we only began to make contact, experiential contact, with the core essential nature of our being, the divine nature of our being, about 5 or 6,000 years ago as a species. And we're just getting started. And so many of our concepts of God and punishment and reward and heaven, hell, I think are just completely inadequate to really understand the true scale and scope of the intention of creation. When we die in the life review, we encounter not only a detailed remembering of everything we've ever done in this lifetime, but we also experience how it impacted, how it touched the lives of those around us, both directly and indirectly touches their lives. And to the extent that we have made bad choices, then that comes back to us in the experience of hell. And to the extent that we've made good choices, that comes back to us in the experience of heaven. But in the end, the goal of this whole system is not to punish us or reward us in some cheap way, but to educate us, to teach us so that we can learn. So we learn from our mistakes and we learn from the things we've done well, and we keep on growing. We keep on moving through. The idea that infinite intelligence and infinite compassion could produce something like the eternal damnation that hell envisions is just ridiculous. It's done so much damage, I think, to human beings through history, and it's just wrong.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the experiences you've had and the concept of the infinite is a very hard concept, you know, to think that you could go on journeying and reincarnating. You know, the mind has to get to a point where it says, enough, you know, I don't want to do this anymore. It's endless.
Yeah.
You know, how do you feel about that?
I think when we die, we go home. I mean, we return to spirit and we return to our soul, the larger in consciousness, and we are brought back into peace, we're brought back into wholeness, and we're brought back home. Now, the trick is there are many, many levels of home. And so you can experience homecoming in the spiritual world at an introductory level, an intermediate level, and a very advanced level. There are many levels of joy. So I think there is a sense in which we get to stop and pause and rest and refresh ourselves after every incarnation. Now, there are sometimes some people die under such traumatic circumstances that can get thrown off in different ways. But for the most part, most people return home without any difficulties. When we are there, we are restored, we are reconnected with the divine, and it's in that context where we make the choice of first whether to incarnate again and where to reincarnate again and ask what to reincarnate again. So what sounds, and so I think it's natural as we go through life, if we live our life well, we're tired at the end. The idea of living multiple times is like, that's exhausting. We're already tired. But from the soul's perspective, it's from the perspective of having been refreshed and rejuvenated, that we voluntarily choose another course of instruction to deepen ourselves as a human being and to help other human beings, because eventually it becomes clear we're not in this alone. We're all in this together. And it's the most natural thing in the world to want to help other human beings in their own evolutionary journey.
You know, when you say that there are so many different levels, you know, that makes a lot of sense to me. so many people write about the afterlife, have messages from the afterlife, hear about, you know, how the loved ones are living in the afterlife or existing, and they're all so contradictory. But if there are many levels, you know, then that really does explain a lot. But the other thing I want to talk about is you talked earlier about transformation. You know, we are on a journey of transformation and we are these sparks. And it makes me think then that we must be very young sparks if we need to keep on being refined and transformed. Yeah. I mean, do older sparks not come back?
Good question. And again, to even begin to address that question, we have to push back the walls of our assumptions. We have to really begin to think deeper and longer and larger. The spiritual traditions that believe in reincarnation say reincarnation is obligatory up to a certain point in our developmental process. So we may drag our feet, we may take time, but sooner or later we have to come back to the reincarnation process. But there comes a time when you no longer have to. Now, the early Eastern traditions said that's the critical moment when you can leave and everybody wants to leave, and that's what the religions are all about, moksha, escape, getting to the pure land, getting to heaven. I don't think that's really what it's all about. But it is a significant turning point, because once we no longer have to participate in the reincarnation cycle, once it's purely purely optional, then we can choose to participate freely and more strategically to support not necessarily our own individual development, maybe, but not necessarily, but to be able to support the development of other human beings. You might think of them as our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren. In the end, from a deep spiritual perspective, they're all our children. They're all our grandchildren. All of humanity is. Now, there are some beings, I think, who have reached that point, and they've gone on to explore other dimensions of existence. The physical universe is only one dimension of a multidimensional cosmos in spiritual reality. So as vast as the physical universe is, it seems to be only one universe out of a multi-universe system. So in order to sort of ask, are there no old souls here, or where do old sparks of light go? That just takes us really deep into the vast expanse of things. You know, when the Buddha was asked this question, he refused to answer it. About where does an enlightened being go? He said that however he answered it, it would confuse the listener, and it was better to just work on your own transformation until you can have the experience of awakening yourself, and then you'll know for your own truth where we're going when we die and what's available to us when we die. Because if you say the awakened one does not exist as they die, then that's leads to a mistake. If you say that the awakened one does exist when they die, that also leads to a mistake, because the conditions are so different than that either or recognizes.
You talked about this incredible intelligent consciousness, this, I'll call it a divine being, because I don't know how else to describe it. Mm-hmm. But of course, calling it a being minimizes it. It's infinite. Is this something that we all can experience?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Because its nature is our nature. And so when we experience the deepest aspect of our own being, we experience its being. We experience its nature. It's impossible to step out of this being. This being, the body of this being, is the body of the universe. All the vast expanse of spiritual reality is the consciousness of the universe, the non-physical aspect of this being. And again, like you, I hesitate to call it a being because that gives it kind of a boundary quality and there are no boundaries. Yeah. But yeah, this is not only can we experience it, but it is our destiny to experience it. And I think when we die, we return to the remembrance of this nature. And that's why we want to incarnate again in order to deepen our experience of our essential nature. It's kind of like when we die, our cup is filled to the brim, but you can have a half a cup, three quarters of a cup, full cup, or two cups, you know, and we want a bigger and bigger cup so we can experience more and more of the divine bliss.
You said in the book how painful it was. It became painful to leave the presence of that being. And that's ultimately one of the reasons why you stopped having the sessions. Yeah. Have you found other ways to experience it that aren't so painful?
The full intensity of communion with the light of existence? No, I have not found other ways of experiencing it in its full intensity. I have committed myself to grabbing physical existence, my physical existence, and not letting it go, and learning to love the manifest body of the divine in that I see around me in every person and in the stars at night. I am comfortable in this world, and I love this world, and I do my spiritual practice, and you know, but in terms of getting access to those same dimensions of diamond luminosity, no, I've had to let go of that for the time being. That said, I know there are beings who do. You know, I know there are great spiritual beings, truly, the Mahasiddhas, the great beings who are able to live in conscious communion with those subtle planes of existence. I don't happen to be one of those beings yet. So I still hope. But I think if I practice every day for the rest of my life in this incarnation, I still would not be able to realize in my particular case, in traditional contemplative practice, the levels of reality that I access, that I was accessing after 20 years of work in this particular form of practice with psychedelics.
But knowing what you know, knowing what it feels like, knowing, you know, where you've been and what you've experienced, it must make life a little bit hard, you know, knowing that that is always there.
It makes it hard and it makes it easier. It makes it easier because now I know it in my heart and in my bones, that we are always surrounded and suffused with this divine intelligence and love, and one can draw on it continuously. So that in that sense, it makes it easier, because the greatest burden, I think, of physical existence is not knowing. And we get driven crazy by not knowing. And that burden has been lifted from me. But it does make it hard in the sense that and this is nothing unique to psychedelic journeys. People who have deep NDEs, near-death experiences, same thing, they have to, it's a challenge to come back into time and space and be content with living here. And that aspect, it is harder because you know that it's there, and you know that it's only your own silliness which is keeping you from enjoying it fully right here, right now. It's only my own imperfections which are keeping me out of that state right here, right now.
This 100 years of transformation that we are going to go through, it's a wonderful thing, and it gives a lot of people a lot of hope. And goodness knows, you know, we're all aware of what's happening in the world today and how challenging that is to live with, and many people are very afraid. But when we're in a human form, if we haven't had the experiences that you've had, it's also very hard to think, I'm not going to see it in my lifetime. I've got to wait a couple of hundred years. That just sounds too much.
You know, I mean, the timetable was not given to me. And the details of the transformation were not given to me in my visionary experiences. What I was given was the experience of the human species undergoing the pain of a deep and profound global collapse. And the beauty and this first and the certainty that we would make it through. And a lot of people are beginning to think that we're not going to make it through. It's an extinction event. My visionary experience is that we do make it through, and we are profoundly changed in this process. You know, it's kind of like, you know, when a woman starts labor in the morning, when she's starting labor, she might think, oh, I don't want to do this today. Let's do something else. But there's no choice. We're in it. And I think that's what's going to happen to us now. We may not want to be in it, but we're in it. And the key to navigating it well is to do it well. Each of us has a small share in this collective transformation. And the actions of individuals have disproportionately large outcomes in a time of intense and accelerated change in nonlinear systems, so that each one of us can have a positive impact on a good outcome of this crisis that we're going through. And I don't know how long it's going to take us, but this is the work of the hour. This is what we are all here working toward.
Yeah. And it's not as though we're not going to experience that transformation, because if we keep coming back, yeah, you know, we're definitely going to be a part of it.
Yeah. And I think the joy, when we begin to experience in between our lifetimes and on Earth eventually, when we experience this new human being that is coming forward in history, and we aren't, you know, nature or the force behind nature is giving birth to this being. When we experience this being, it's just like experience a newborn babe. It will all be worth it. All the pain and suffering will be worth it. This is an extraordinary event in human history.
Chris Bache, I'm afraid we're out of time. Thank you for adding your 10 best list of spiritual books to the No BS Spiritual Book Club's library of recommendations. And thank you for taking that journey for all of us.
Thank you, Sandy. Thank you for the work you're doing. Thank you for the tremendous source of information that you bring into the world. You're just doing such good work. And thank you for the attention you've paid my work.
Thank you, Chris. So Christopher Bache's 10 best list can be found at the No BS Spiritual Book Club. And if you go to Sandy's Bookworms, you can download an excerpt from LSD and the Mind of the Universe, Diamonds from Heaven, which is published by Inner Traditions Bear and Company. For more information about Chris's articles, events, and other books, visit his website at chrisbache.com. This show is also available as a free downloadable podcast at ometimes.com, Spotify, iTunes, Amazon, Audible, and all of the major podcast platforms. So if you'd rather listen than view, you know where to go for it. That's it for this week. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. I'll be back at the same time next week with another 10 best interview for the No BS Spiritual Book Club. Till then, it's goodbye from me, and thank you deeply to Chris Bache.
Thank you, Sandy.